Accession number 18802, reel 14.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 14. You were describing the tactics of watch and ward.
I think when you talk about a screen, I think I need to make it clear that we're talking of two-man foxholes, and I'm not sure that did emerge last time we discussed it. So we're talking of the spread out along a river, all dug into the bank or just near the bank, in two-man foxholes, and they were expected to stay there and get on with it.
What sort of intervals would there be between foxholes in terms of distance?
Depended very much on the ground, but not too widely dispersed.
And you also mentioned that you would have to concentrate the reserve to make counterattacks. How was this organised? Did you have the brigade organised into ad hoc combat or battle groups, which normally trained and worked together? Or would you have put mixed forces of armoured infantry together on an ad hoc basis?
Well, one battalion was committed to the watch and ward thing, and so that left two battalions and an armoured regiment. And my recollection is that the armoured regiment and one battalion were sort of located more or less together. And I can't remember what happened to the other battalion, to be honest.
Could it have been used to hold a firm base?
Yes. But the essential thing was to be able to commit the reserve, the counterattack force. It's hardly a reserve, really. I mean, it was all part of the initial holding operation, and the reserve came from behind and was thrown in if necessary. Had nothing to do with the brigade as such.
So the brigade was to deal with the initial
yes.
attempt at penetration by the enemy.
That's right.
Sounds as if one can use the phrase rather like a reconnaissance screen in force.
Yes, I think it was perhaps a little bit more than that, but that's on the right lines.
When the brigade actually launched its attack against the enemy, what form was that going to take? Would it be an attempt to overrun the enemy coming in from a flank, or would it be a case of finding a suitable defensive location and setting up an anti-tank ambush, or some other form of tactics?
I think fairly flexible, depending really on what the penetration was, how it was organised, what it consisted of, and I think the plans for I hesitate to use the word the counterattack force, it's the strike force, let's call it.
Yes.
The plans for it varied depending on exactly how the penetration was coming about.
What was the role of the artillery?
Well, first of all, as you pointed out earlier on, I'd said it was based on tactical nuclear weapons. I mean, the whole thing, looking back on it now, with the benefit of hindsight, I mean, the whole thing was unreal. I mean, I think if one is honest. But it was the way everybody was thinking at that particular time.
And were you expecting to get close air support? Well, that's another aspect one needs to think about.
Yes, I think we were, but we didn't have a resident airman. And I think we relied very much on the commanding officer of the field regiment for all the supporting fire, whether it was ground or air. And both talking of the nuclear side, on the one hand, he was the nuclear advisor for the brigade, and also the ordinary field artillery. And any extra artillery that came along, medium guns or whatever, all went under his command. And, you know, he was the, I'd put it in sort of one way. He was sort of our CRA.
What sort of firepower could he normally offer you in a theoretical way for exercise or planning purposes? What sort of scale of effort?
Well, I think, again, perhaps that's part of the unreal side of all this, because I don't think people really took account of possible ammunition shortages or anything like that. You know, if we wanted to fire a lot of guns, we fired a lot of guns. And, I don't think it was realistic.
Were the field pieces, were they self-propelled by that stage, or were they towed?
I think they were towed. I don't think we got to the self-propelled stage. I think we're talking 25-pounders.
And what about anti-tank guns? How were they controlled and deployed?
Well, we didn't have any anti-tank guns from outside. We relied entirely on our own tanks, tank regiment, and our own infantry anti-tank guns. And that really was it.
How are the tactical nuclear weapons to be delivered? Were they to be delivered by air or by guided weapon or by artillery?
My recollection is that Lance had come along by that time, and so I think we were expecting to use that. And otherwise, we're talking about artillery.
So this would be medium or heavy?
Yes.
Artillery?
Yes.
What about liaison with flanking forces? How was that to be carried out? Was that to go back through a divisional link, or were you to have lateral communication and liaison with brigades on either side?
Well, first of all, we hoped that the radio would work. And, of course, on exercises it always did, which perhaps was added to the unreality of it all. There was liberal use of LOs, both to the flanks and to division.
Do you happen to know how long it was expected you would be able to actually hold up or delay the enemy before having to withdraw or being overrun?
Well, I think we're talking in terms of days rather than weeks. I don't think we ever put an actual time on it. I mean, I suppose the old cry, do your best, was all we were saying.
What about these chaps in the forward screen and the two-man foxholes? How were they supposed to get back, or were they just supposed to stay there until the Russians rolled back eastwards?
They were supposed to stay there, and then, I regret to say, they had to use their initiative and do the best they could to get out.
The case of Soki Per.
Yeah. I mean, there was no conceivable way in which one could have centralised their evacuation, if that's what it came to.
Were these plans tested effectively and exhaustively by exercise?
They were certainly tested. Whether they were tested effectively is perhaps a moot point. But it happened, and people did sit out in their foxholes for many days without being discovered, which in itself was quite interesting. But again, I think the exercises we ran with troops, and there weren't too many of them, there weren't perhaps enough of those at formation level. They, I think, tested adequately, but perhaps not effectively, not wholly effectively. But we did quite a lot of toots of one sort or another. Toots is the wrong word, although there were some of those. Signal exercises at formation level. And they were, I think, quite effective, certainly in terms of testing communications and testing the sort of distances one could operate over. But I can remember one where the British Corps was being exercised as a whole on a signal basis, and 12th Brigade was made the enemy. And there was a man called Lewis Pugh, who you may have come across, who appeared as a major general to be the sort of senior enemy commander, and he used my headquarters as his base, and we were sort of representing motor rifle divisions and God knows what, and I think perhaps we were a bit unrealistic in that we fairly poured motor rifle divisions of various sorts in various directions, and I think exercised the Corps no end. Whether what we did was, again, realistic from a Soviet, as it then was, point of view, is perhaps, again, a moot point. But we had quite a lot of fun doing it. And Lewis Pugh was certainly very complimentary about the way it all went.
Do you remember where you got your information about the Soviet forces and their likely tactics and operations?
Well, we read a lot of what you might call the background papers on the subject, pamphlets, etc. I don't remember anything specific, and as far as that particular exercise was concerned, we used our imagination quite a bit. Rather too much, I suspect.
You were saying earlier on that everyone was thinking along the same lines of the watch and ward and the strike force and the use of tactical nuclear weapons. Do you happen to know where the ideas originated? You know, who was the man who originally thought the idea up and propagated it?
Well, when you say everybody, I'm not sure everybody was convinced. I think I'm right in saying that it all originated in 12 Brigade. The imagination of Pat Mann, who was the second of the brigadiers I served under there. And he was a very determined infantryman, and I think he worked this out and practiced it and so on. And I think others came along afterwards, some of them rather reluctantly, I suspect. But certainly a year or two later, I went back to the staff college for an exercise of theirs called Black Tarquin, and they were practicing this very system, and indeed I went back because of my 12 Brigade connections.
It does sound as though the idea had caught on, and
yes,
been taken up by
I think that's
higher
right.
levels.
Yes. But how passionately it was believed in, I would find it difficult to say. And looking back on it all, I mean, the reliance on nuclear weapons seems to be iffy.
Why iffy? Because of the political complications of getting release?
Yes, and as one, you know, it's some years ago we're talking about when all this was taking place, and if you look at the present scene, I would find it difficult to say that, and I don't know what they're doing now. I mean, I've no idea how they're practicing in Rhine Army now. I've no idea what their systems are. But I think complete reliance on nuclear weapons perhaps is not part of it. But I may be wrong.
Roughly how much time was actually spent out on the ground by the soldiers in the brigade when you were brigade major? Have you no idea of the proportion of time they were out in the field?
As far as the units were concerned, they went out, perhaps for shortish periods, at regular intervals. As far as the brigade was concerned, signal exercises took place perhaps once a month, something of that sort. And as far as with troops are concerned, probably 3 or 4 weeks towards the end of the summer.
I was going to ask whether this tactical concept suited one part of the year more than another, because the changing of the seasons can have a considerable effect on how you fight.
I don't think we made allowance for any change of seasons.
So it was always late summer, early autumn.
What, as far as the
big
manoeuvres
are concerned, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think to an extent that was to do with damage to property. But I'm talking now of formation exercises. Other exercises
yes.
took place more regularly throughout the year.
But presumably you could only practice this particular style of operation when you've got the whole brigade out into the
yes.
field.
As far as everybody on the ground is concerned, yes. As far as signal exercises were concerned, we could do it more often.
Any time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you were in the brigade for 3 years, so presumably that would mean three grand manoeuvres.
3 years? 2 years.
I 2 years.
Oh. I think I arrived in April 60 and left in November 60. I arrived in November 58 and left in April 58 and left in November 60.
Right. So there were two. Was there any development in the second set of manoeuvres as a result of things that had happened during the first? Do you remember noticing any progression, development?
No changes as such. I think the main development would be that more people had got the philosophy into their systems, and therefore it became perhaps easier for people to deploy in the way we've been describing.
And were these just purely brigade exercises, or did they coincide with exercises at higher level, at divisional level?
At that particular time, we're talking of brigade exercise, but one of them was a test exercise set by a division, and that was in November 1960.
Was the divisional commander enthusiastic about this idea? Do you happen to know what he thought of it?
I don't happen to know, I'm afraid, no. But, no, I can't answer that question.
What were your main tasks as brigade major as you saw them? And did they change when the brigade commander changed?
I don't think the tasks changed because, as the chief of staff of the brigade, one did what you might call the traditional things that chiefs of staff do. Certainly the atmosphere changed with the new brigadier, yes, very much so, because they were two completely and utterly different characters. And I'm not going to tell you which one I preferred.
What are these traditional things that chiefs of staff always have to do?
Well, organisation on the one hand. Using the old-fashioned terminology of G staff and A staff and Q staff, the brigade major did all the G side, the intelligence side, the training side, the operational side, and the staff duties side, which people sometimes forget. And he also was the commanding officer of brigade headquarters, which again people sometimes forget. Although there was an OC headquarter company, and the signal squadron had a commander, the brigade major, in fact, even although younger than them and junior to them, perhaps in service, etc., he actually was the senior officer of the brigade headquarters other than the brigadier.
Which of these duties took up most of your time?
I suppose training, on the whole. Intelligence, quite a lot, because of, studying the Soviet side and so on. But operations, which you would think perhaps took the main part of one's time, sadly didn't, because, we thought training and intelligence and SD were going to happen today and tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, whereas operations we thought was some rather indeterminate time in the future.
A remote prospect.
Yes. That's really, I think, how we felt. And so the operational side, I mean, just to take one example, I only just completed what you might call an op order for the operational plan, literally just before I left, to hand over to my successor.
Did you inherit one when you arrived?
No.
So your predecessor hadn't done as well as you had in producing?
I think things had changed.
Things had changed.
Yeah.
Was the brigade run in a formal manner? Were there regular routine conferences and meetings, or did things tend to be discussed as they arose?
I mean, there were occasional CO's conferences, which everybody was encouraged to say their piece completely openly, even if it was contrary to what other people were saying. I can't remember how many actually took place each year, but they were fairly regular events. There were O groups of one sort or another for exercises. And as far as sort of running the brigade was concerned, I mean, obviously I talked to the brigade commander daily, sometimes hourly, depending on just what was on. And I think the first brigadier I served, I mean, I think he accepted me for what I was as a professional staff officer. I don't think he probably had quite the same feeling for me as he had for my predecessor, who'd been with him from the time the brigade formed. With the second brigadier, I had complete and utter trust between us.
Were you his right hand?
Yes.
Did you have a normal routine working day, or did each day make itself up as it went along?
Each day tended to make itself up as it went along.
You mentioned that one of your responsibilities was training, a major responsibility. Did you have freedom within the brigade to design your own training program, or were you given a sort of external skeleton by division or higher level?
There was a divisional training directive, I remember. But within that directive, and obviously if there were certain things that were musts, they had to be included in our own program. But otherwise, we were free to have our own training directive or training, whatever you like to call it. I think directive is probably the right word.
Was there any particular aspect of training which you emphasised as being of greater importance than others?
Shooting. And indeed we had an annual rifle meeting for which I was responsible, but that more or less ran itself. Shooting signals and the importance of radio, and I suppose the operational philosophy.
Presumably that would be disseminated mainly to officers, to
yes.
junior commanders rather than to
yes.
the soldiers in the brigade.
But the soldiers were expected to be informed and to be properly briefed. And indeed, when the brigade commander was going round, he asked a lot of pertinent questions right down the scale of private soldiers and junior NCOs and everybody to make sure they did actually know what he wanted.
How did he normally spend his time? Was he in his headquarters or was he out visiting?
If you asked me to put a percentage on it, I couldn't. But certainly he did go out visiting a lot. And indeed, one of the reasons for sort of trust as between him and me was that I was left to run the shop. And he got on with thinking on the one hand and visiting on the other hand.
Did you have to maintain a sort of watching brief over A and Q matters as well as G matters, or were you content just to allow the staff officers in charge of those departments to get on with it on their own?
The DAQ and I, first of all, he was older than me, quite a bit, about four years older initially, and then we got another one when he finished his tour. We got on very well together, and we've remained friends ever since, and our families sort of correspond with each other and so on. And so I think he was, you know, when I arrived as a youngster, as it were, in relative terms, I think he was a bit suspicious to start with, but we got on very well quite quickly. And we discussed things regularly between ourselves, and although I was overall responsible for the whole outfit, as far as the detail was concerned, I very much left it to him to get on with it. But if he had a problem, he came and talked about it. And if I had a problem, I went and talked to him about it.
All done by informal verbal
yes.
communication.
Yes.
How big was the headquarters and the headquarters company? You mentioned that you were commanding HQ company.
You know, I can't remember. It was small, and indeed one of the things I inherited from my predecessor was he said one of the key words is miniaturization, part and parcel of spreading out and deploying and, you know, getting out of the way of enemy nukes and so on. But fully carried out for miniaturization, everything would have been on a fully Land Rover or Jeep basis. We hadn't quite got to that. We got quite close to that. But we still had a massive sort of 3-ton command vehicle, which was a bit old-fashioned.
Was that a wheeled vehicle?
Yes.
A box-bodied truck?
Yes.
Like the old Bedford QL, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly that.
What measures did you have in place for the security of headquarters?
Well, we had a defence platoon, and that was made up largely of Yugoslavs who'd been displaced persons and were sort of taken on by the British Army. But, you know, we had regular stand-tos and so on, and regular interruptions of one's ordinary work when we were in the field. As far as protection in barracks was concerned, we just relied on what you might call normal security measures. And indeed, one of the IRA bombs of 12 months ago, whenever it was, the one that Bernadette Devlin's daughter was wanted for by the Germans, took place in the barracks that we used to be in.
At Osnabrück?
At Osnabrück.
Mm. What were those barracks like?
We shared them with an infantry battalion, which when I first went there was the Gloucesters. And we all fitted in quite well, and it was a sort of bungalow-type camp. I mean, pretty oldie-worldy. But we fitted in quite well, and we were reasonably comfortable.
Well, was it an old barracks or relatively new? You said it was old-worldy. Was this pre-Second World War or Second World War vintage?
I think it was Second World War vintage. Mm. And the Germans had had a similar sort of, I think they'd had a school there of some sort.
Did you have adequate facilities for training within the barrack area and
within
proximity?
The barrack area, very poor. But we had our own little local training area a few miles away called ACMA. And indeed, my recollection of my arrival in 12 Brigade was, I think I arrived at the end of April. On the 1st of May, we went out on a 3-day headquarter exercise at ACMA in snow for the first 4 days of May. So that was my introduction to 12 Brigade on the one hand and Germany on the other.
A nice change from Malaya.
Yes.
How did you get on with the local Germans?
It's a very tiresome question to answer because My ins-